Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and today we're talking international advocacy, human development programs, and some of the stuff that's actually really important now in terms of the Irish context, our place in the world now, and how we can advocate for change, because we have more influence than we maybe have in other times, Martin, as we've discussed on this podcast previously. We have a seat at the table these days.
Yeah, we have a seat on the UN Council, and it's something we can crow about, or it's something we can use. So I am very much in favor that we use it as best we can. And there's a lot of areas that we can use it in.
Yeah, I'm for that. We are joined by two eminently qualified guests. And again, it's one of those where you read people's bios and realize how unfulfilled your life is. But we are joined by Katrina Dowd, who's Assistant Professor in Security Studies at DCU School of Law and Government, and Rachel Nikalikar, who's Head of International Advocacy with Concern Worldwide. Ladies, thank you both so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having us.
Rachel, can I start with you? Because this conversation was instigated on the back of a report that you guys put out in terms of, and it was the phrase, I think I tweeted the phrase because it was one of those, I'm a sucker for a good line. And it was, surviving war was one thing, but surviving the hunger is worse. Do you want to just give listeners the context of what that report was from and what you guys were talking about within that?
Sure. So we've just launched a campaign called Nothing Kills Like Hunger. And it was from that campaign that we have, in our work, obviously we work in 23 countries, and conflict is increasingly one of the biggest challenges that we face. So you think that it's conflict that actually kills people, but in reality, it's the hunger that kills people, because what we're seeing is that conflicts are lasting longer and longer. And the longer they last, the less time they get, you know, in the media, the less interest there is in the crisis, the more desperate people get, because over time they've spent all their savings, they've moved country, or they've had to move out of their home, they've been pushed off their farms. So hunger eventually catches up on people. You can't live on rations year on year. You can't have small children, you know, born into really difficult circumstances where their mother hasn't had adequate nutrition, then the children aren't getting adequate nutrition, and on it goes. And so it's hunger is a bigger killer than conflict in so many crises around the world. And that's the basis of the campaign. And also within that is a really deliberate element of conflicts that we're seeing increasingly, and Katrina will talk about this in more detail as well, is where the sources of food are being deliberately cut off. So when a crisis, when a conflict starts, then, you know, how things go, there'll either be an attack in an urban area and people will flee to rural areas and they won't be able to go back to the city, or the reverse happens, that people in their village are pushed off it, and whether it's armed groups come in and they kill everybody, or they abuse, you know, they violate the women and they push everybody off the land. And people then become really scared of being able to farm. There might be crops in the field, but they just can't feed themselves. And so more and more what we're seeing then is that it's being used as a deliberate tactic of war to terrorize people off the land and basically starve them. Either into submission or just starve them as part of the opposition. So it's quite chilling, but it's very real, and we're seeing it reinforced in more and more contexts.
And we're seeing it more, like you refer to the length of the conflicts now. And I'm gonna get in trouble because it's one of my favorite authors is Aaron Dahi Roy, and she writes brilliantly about lifestyle wars and how you know we kind of outsource them to these other countries. But Katrina, if I could come to you in terms of the use of first of all the use of hunger as an implement of war, and the idea that these wars are kind of forever wars now in many ways, and that just plays into this notion of how we view conflict traditionally as good guys fight bad guys or whatever it is, and then everybody just kisses and makes up later on. That's not the case anymore.
No, and, you know, in fact, it probably never was, but it's certainly not the case now. And we are seeing that change, that it's much more protracted. We're seeing conflicts that are lasting longer. And when we see conflicts maybe abate or there's some kind of temporary resolution or some steps towards peace, we're seeing much more likely that people are re-entering, getting trapped in a conflict cycle. We're much more likely to see conflict recurring in contexts again and again. And as Rachel said, there are these different ways in which conflict is causing hunger. It's not a surprise to people to think that conflict in general makes people more food insecure. It affects trade and markets. It affects whether or not you can get to your farms. But what we're seeing and really focusing on a lot more, both at a policy level and in the work that groups like Concern are doing, are this deliberate targeting of food and food systems. And that really means that armed groups are going out of their way to specifically and strategically target food in order to make people more food insecure, in order to punish people, in order to move people, in order to prevent humanitarian access from or humanitarian assistance from reaching them. And I think that's really significant that we pay attention to that, because, you know, you mentioned this kind of maybe a traditional idea of thinking about hunger. We used to think, or many people used to think about famine as something that was kind of a natural apocalyptic phenomenon, something that we couldn't explain, couldn't be avoided. It was a terrible tragedy, but it was somehow inevitable. And in fact, what we know now is that famine is created by people, it's created by policies, and there's nothing natural or inevitable about it. We have the ability to respond to food crises effectively. But what we're seeing more and more is that where food is leveraged and weaponized in war, we're just not able to address those needs fast enough, effectively enough, or long term enough. And of course, at the tail end of that, then we have not just the conflicts are lasting so long and they're more likely to recur, but you also have that long, long legacy of what it does to people in conflict to then try and rebuild their livelihoods. It's not even when the conflict is over that things go back to normal or nearly normal. There's a long shadow cast by conflict and hunger. And we can see that even if we think about the resonance of famine in Ireland alone, that that's something that resonates with us almost 200 years later. But food systems and livelihoods for a long time are affected.
Absolutely. And it is generational. It changes the people. There's no doubt that it changes. And I suppose, you know, 20 years ago, we saw this with Somalia, and we were used to the idea that food was used as a weapon in Somalia, very much so. But 20 years down the line, it's still not, you know, it's still used as a weapon in Somalia. And now we see Yemen as well. Has COVID, I mean, we were on the precipice of probably the worst food disaster year before COVID. Has COVID exacerbated that?
To a degree, yes. I suppose there's a whole long list of things that COVID has done. First of all, it has distracted, it's taken the attention off some of these crises, because we've had to look internally and we, you know, people looking at domestic policies and trying to figure out how did we deal with COVID. Also in terms of funding and looking at, you know, where money was supposed to go, all of that stuff has been impacted. You saw probably that like the UK cut their aid budget earlier this year, and that's had a really harsh knock-on effect on programs. COVID in the countries where we work is a really interesting one, and we're trying to figure out like whether there's a pattern or not. And really there isn't a pattern. I mean, if we talk to our colleagues in Kenya or Ethiopia or Somalia at the moment, it's like COVID is not the big concern. It's hunger. It's still trying to feed your children.
I'm going to pause the podcast because we have big news. We have big news. It's been a while since we've been back on the live scene, Martin, but we are going back. The Tortoise Shack is coming back in November to the Sugar Club in Dublin, which is a fabulous venue for a live podcast. The last time we were in the Sugar Club, we were actually the guests of Blind Boy, which was a phenomenal night. And we're hoping to do that with some of your favorite podcasts from across the Tortoise Shack. And if you are a member right now on patreon.com/Tortoise Shack, the link is there. You can get in there, you can go in, and there's a quite hefty discount for our supporters, our members. So, you know, it's well worth signing up. But Martin, are you looking forward to getting back?
Tony, so do you remember the last time we were on stage?
Yeah.
I remember the last time on stage. And do you know what? Do you know what came out of that show? that's just really scary when you think about it. We talked about a coalition of Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael. We talked about
We talked about a hung doll. And yeah. I said potentially a hung doll. And I remember, I think it was it Breed Smith was there, or we asked everybody, because there was people from all the parties across the thing, and we asked them all for their predictions. And I think I'm wrong. It was Richard Boyd Barrett and Jack Chambers, your friend Jack Chambers of the commemorations was there, and then you said something, and this is me not to give you credit. You said, yeah, but then again, this thing that's coming in from China might change everything.
Yeah, that was January 2019, Tony. January 2000. God, how time flies. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to getting back into it. I'm looking forward to the rest of the tour, seeing the rest of the Tortoise Shack crew, Tony. Really looking forward to seeing the rest of the Tortoise Shack crew.
All the podcasts that you enjoy will be on stage in Dublin Sugar Club in November. Patreon.com/Tortoise Shack, well worth it. You know, like the bloody the discount alone is well worth signing up for, but also is the content. Support the independent media that you listen to. And it doesn't have to be us. It has to be, but please, because I can tell you, they're all struggling out there at the moment. And we're taking a risk going live now, but we genuinely think that these are the best shows that people will get the most fun, information, and a good night out at.
Patreon.com/Tortoise Shack. Let you go back to your podcast now.
The big concern, it's hunger. It's still trying to feed your children. And if you go back to the secondary impacts of COVID, you know, the fact that we weren't all going on holidays to places that depended 100% on tourism. So the whole economy crashed, then people really had nothing to survive on. So like, even though COVID wasn't the issue, people were, it was poverty and extreme hunger became the issue for so many people. And then the fact that businesses, people weren't purchasing. We've seen from Bangladesh to Kenya to Malawi, all the impact of the global economic.
Well, but the global supply chain falling is so clear to see. Like, we spoke to Tao in Vietnam last week, and she was given out to us because of Ireland's role in global tax avoidance, and she said, "You're so proud of it," and she was kind of, but she listed out, you know, when you do that, we could employ 3,500 extra nurses, but you do that, and she gave the granular detail that, like, you know, we need to be honest about and what that actually means in developing countries. But I also struck by what you said about the cuts to the overseas development budgets, because it's budget season. We're going to have this conversation the next few days, and there's kites flying everywhere outside my window. But very much like that, you know, we're at that stage where, unfortunately, there's been a rise of and it's across the board in a lot of Western countries of look after our own mentality in some of this, and we forget that we are in a joined up system. I mean, you know, food insecurity, the food insecurity is a global issue. It's not we all depend on one another. So, like, we had a conversation with Sinead Moles yesterday. I don't know if you know Sinead, but she wrote a paper for Oxfam on global supply chains, food supply chains. And, you know, you're looking at it going, how do we not really see how
interconnected?
Exactly. Yeah. So just in terms of the budget, though, like, are there specific things that, like, the last time we spoke, Ireland wasn't honouring its deal anyway. So how are we doing now?
I'm actually going to see Minister Brophy tomorrow morning. So it's a really good opportunity. And we're having a face to face with the minister and with some of our DOCUS colleagues, the Irish NGOs. And one of the big questions is, when will we get to 0.7%? So Ireland is currently at 0.3%. So the 0.7% commitment is that by 2030, in order to meet the SDGs, that we get to 0.7. So Ireland is currently at 0.32%. And there is a roadmap. There was a question from Brendan Howland a couple of months ago in the Dáil, and so Minister Brophy presented a roadmap which we feel isn't enough in order to meet the commitments. There's only 7 more budgets before 2030, which is quite scary when you look at it like that. But really, if we are serious about our commitment. And it really does come back to your point, Martin, on our place in the world and how we use our place in the world. But it's how joined up we are and how committed we are in terms of the money that we give to overseas aid. And it's, you know, yes, we have our own needs and so on. The funding for 2021 was 868 million, which is a lot. But then across the NGOs and the UN and so on, and the Irish embassies and all the networks and the nuns and everybody who is part of that chain of overseas aid, there's a lot of work done with it. So it really, Ireland gets its value out of overseas aid. And, you know, I think it is, we are a very rich country and we do want to have a place in the world. But it's also really important for us as a very small country that we do have that recognition in the world. So I think whatever we put into overseas aid, we get back tenfold. That's but right. it's a tricky argument sometimes.
I'm struck by what you said about how many budgets there is between now and 2030. And I would say, look how many governments there is between now and 2030. There is literally going to be one more government between now and 2030. And that's quite scary when you think of the responsibility.
Yeah.
We do have an opportunity now in that we do have a seat on the UN Council, something that the government fought very hard for. And it's something where we can actually exercise real influence. Katrina, if I come to you on this, what influence should we be exercising?
Well, I think we've not only had a seat, but we've just concluded recently as president of the Security Council. So we've been not just at the table, but running the conversation, I suppose, for the last month. And I think what we've seen from Ireland is that they've had a commitment around three key areas. And I think they're really welcome ones. They've been talking about peace building. So they're really focused on how can we actually build peace rather than having maybe a hard security approach to saying, how do we make the world more secure? They're talking about building peace, which is a really positive, I think, voice for peace on the world stage. Talking about strengthening prevention of conflict. So again, let's not wait until conflicts break out, but let's try and work on ways that we can see opportunities to act earlier, to see kind of warning signs, and to work with the peace building and the diplomatic tools that are at our disposal. And the third has been around ensuring accountability. And that basically means where there have been violations of rights, that they're pursuing and looking to strengthen accountability. And I think all three of those are really strong areas and areas that Ireland stands out on. We've seen a little bit more focus in some of those areas, particularly around peace building. They've had a big focus on peacekeepers, for instance, during their time on the Security Council so far. And I think that speaks to, again, an aspect that I think touches on this question about aid. Ireland, I think, does best on the world stage when it's speaking to areas in which it has credibility and has experience. And we have a long history of peacekeeping. And so when Ireland speaks about peacekeeping on a stage, even a global stage where Ireland is a small player, it has more credibility when we're talking about peacekeeping as a long-standing troop contributing country. And so they've sought to have a really specific impact there, even as a small country. And the second, I suppose, it's not a, you know, it's interesting. It's both Rachel and I on the call. They have a big focus on women, peace and security. And I think that's a big aspect that Ireland actually brings to the table. It might surprise people that some of these areas are key priority areas for Ireland internationally, whether it's peacekeeping, women, peace and security or nuclear disarmament. But they've had a big focus on how can we make the world safer for women? How can we ensure that women are engaging and leading, but not just participating, but leading peace building efforts?
Yeah, I was going to say that. Have they also identified that women are the driver for peace in many regions? Have they identified that as well?
They have, and I think that's a really welcome nuance that we see with Irish foreign policy around this. It's not simply about talking about women as victims of conflict, which of course women suffer in specific ways, but they've really focused on what women can do to be leaders of change and leaders of peace building, and not just saying it's enough to have women at the table, let's say, in peace negotiations. They need to be meaningfully participating. And I think that's a level of nuance that we don't always see when we think about kind of gender inclusion. Sometimes it's about just having those numbers or ticking that box. But I think Ambassador Bernaysen in particular is seized of that and has shown a lot of leadership on that. So I think that's a key area that Ireland is having an impact and can continue to do quite a bit on.
It's positive that you say that, because I mean, if we always say this all the time, and it sounds like I'm going to get a dig here, but we talk about when you're, if your activism isn't feminist, well, then you're not really doing it right, because, you know, the burden has been carried by, we see it over COVID, the unpaid work, we see it in taxation and fair taxation across the globe. Yeah. It falls predominantly on women. And you also see it in food insecurity, Rachel. It's in that report, clear as day, that there's a gendered aspect to this. Absolutely. As well.
Yeah. And I think just to go back to what Katrina was saying around prevention, like if you look at the cost to women around gender-based violence and maternal health, it's breathtaking that, you know, how much women suffer when a conflict breaks out. So the emphasis has to really be on prevention, because you can't undo all of that suffering. And, you know, in so many places, in so many crises, they round up the men, they kill the men. Mm-hmm. And then they go for the women and children. And then the older women are left carrying the burden. And the emphasis really does have to be on preventing these crises from happening, because it does then, you know, you end up with cyclical violence. You have young men who are growing up with no role models. You have young women who are growing up and they have no sense of their place in the world. They have very limited opportunities where they may have some access to education. But the number of young women in very poor countries and conflict-affected countries that can actually get through secondary school is minuscule. And I think on the food security side as well, you know, the burden on women, I think everyone has an idea of it when we talk about water and rural areas and the burden that women have, you know, walking long distances to collect water and so on. But actually, figuring out how you're going to feed your children, how you're going to feed them, keep them safe, is really, the burden really does fall on women. What we're seeing in some places, which is great, we do a lot of work on community management of acute malnutrition. And the core of that is in the name, obviously, and it's trying to find the solutions within the community. So working with community health workers and putting high value nutrition foods into communities so that women don't have to walk long distances, or families actually, because we do get, in fairness, in some places we do get a lot of dads who are now getting involved and supporting, and you know, you see those signs of equality and much more equity in how families are caring for their own children. And I think we forget sometimes, we're always talking on where the problems are, but there's some really excellent examples where you have families taking a much more kind of shared approach to raising their kids, and it's really important.
You mentioned Kenya earlier, and one of our favorite guests is Caroline Otham, and she's in Kenya, but she's one of the heads in the Global Alliance for Tax Justice, and very much like that, you know, it's brilliant. She's driving this forward, talking about fair taxation, talking through it through a feminist lens. But quite often we're recording, and she still has the burden of childcare, I can tell you, you know. So it is the work. Sorry, Martin, go ahead.
Can I ask, are the connections between refugees, also, which may be economic migrants, but they're actually hunger migrants, is that connection being drawn between conflict, famine, and refugees? Is that part of the picture?
Very much so. And maybe I'll hand over to Katrina to talk in more detail on the kind of the long term impacts. But if you look, even if you look at the Horn of Africa and Central Africa, and you look at the hundreds of thousands of people, you know, 150,000 people in Kakuma refugee camp, or, you know, people who move and migrate in huge numbers simply to get food. And safety. I mean, the thing is, you can't really separate food and protection. And that's mm-hmm. back to where we started in the conversation, is where people are hungry, they're also really at risk because of the conflict. So people move towards refugee camps, they move across borders for safety. So the two are really, really interconnected. And in terms of long-term displacement, you know, the average length of I think we talked about this before, the average length of displacement is now between 17 and 20 years. And it's heartbreaking when you think of it, that like families moved from Syria in 2010, thinking this will be temporary. You know, you take what you need, you go across the border. And then if you look at all the excellent work that's been done on the pathways of tracking how people have had to move, and they end up, you know, somewhere they never imagined that they would end up living, whether it's Greece or Serbia or wherever, still thinking that, you know, that they're going to be settled at some point. But it is that the people move for safety and they move for food and some sense that they're going to be able to, even education, like, you know, the idea that finding some form of education for kids is just, it's so important, and they really are the basics. I'll hand over to Katrina. Yeah. Sorry.
No, I think, you know, it bringing together quite a few of these things, like the other key aspect of that, of course, is climate crisis.
Yes.
And the large number of climate refugees. And I and people displaced more locally. I mean, we talk about refugees as sort of maybe popular shorthand for people who've been displaced. The vast majority of people who are forced out of their homes stay in their countries or stay in their region. So they go to a neighboring country. And we tend to have this narrative in Ireland or in the global north around the refugee crisis. In fact, if there is such a crisis, it's very much in the neighboring countries around these conflicts.
Can
I
say, just because, again, it's something we're going back to soon on Lebanon. We're going to be talking about Lebanon again shortly. And there are generations have grown up in insecure as with refugee status in Lebanon. So, you know, it's important that we point it out. And right now that country is on its knees. It has.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know,
yeah.
Like when we will be covering it again for listeners' benefits, we want to keep a spotlight on it. But sorry, Katrina. Yeah, go ahead.
No, and I think that's you know, an excellent example of that, precisely that really complex kind of an emergency. I suppose maybe to muddy the waters a bit, one of the risks, I would say, sometimes when we think about conflict and displacement or climate and hunger and displacement, is that, of course, absolutely, these are factors that are figuring into people's decisions to move or figuring into people not having a decision. But one of the risks sometimes is that, I suppose, I would be wary when we start to see governments or states talking about climate or talking about addressing hunger in order to prevent migration or in order to prevent refugee movements. And I don't think that's the case with a lot of kind of good faith actors who are concerned with the humanitarian crisis. But there is this sort of window of opportunity where these kinds of crises can be leveraged and serve as a bit of a fig leaf for actually saying what we want is to address climate or address hunger or address humanitarian crises so that people don't migrate. And in fact, or so that people don't seek protection, which they're entitled to. And I think that is partly one of the areas that I think if you're watching these kinds of policy debates, it's to be alert to the possibility that those narratives can sometimes be conflated, and we can sometimes see actors, states and governments or institutional actors, if we're looking at, you know, groups like the EU, using some of that language that can be sometimes about saying
they have
not let's address this so Brexit, that we don't
No, but it, like, the EU response to the Taliban come back into power has not been great, to be honest. Like, it's they've strengthened borders in areas, and we don't really talk too often about Fortress Europe in enough. And, you know, like, and again, I know from other people on the ground that Ireland has actually done quite well in trying to bring people in from Afghanistan, which is really heartening to hear. And but nonetheless, when you look at the numbers that we do, you know, I recall when you mentioned Syria, and Enda Kenny said Ireland stands ready to stand ready, basically, because he pledged something like 4,000 and we brought in 400, you know. So we haven't been great in some of this. But putting that aside, I do want to go back to the climate challenge, because it's you know, we've come out of COVID and we've seen how parts of the world, right, let's put this honestly, part of the world, even when they screwed up by governance, they were able to print enough money to keep the show on the road and produce all the vaccines and then create all this this thing. But it won't be that easy when the climate crisis hits, Katrina. And we talked about these conflicts, the nature of just water as a commodity, food as a commodity, you know, all of that, it's going to be much more difficult to navigate that in the coming years unless we act globally and stop this thinking locally nonsense.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, again, to think about Ireland and its role in the UN Security Council, they did recently chair a high level debate around climate and security and really tried to get that on the table. And I think, you know, sometimes there's a simplistic narrative, this idea that, well, there's going to be pressure on resources and therefore we're going to just automatically see this explosion of violence and chaos and unrest. And in reality, I think the story is a little bit more complex in that where we see insecurity and climate interacting is generally in places where we already have a lot of inequality, where you already have a lot of poor governance, where you already have people who are on the margins of the state, or they're being marginalized from the economic system.
There are drones quite at the moment flying up into the sky in Dubai to make rain. And then it's not raining in Yemen a few, you know, down the road, and no one can grow their crops. So, you know, this already exists. This is playing out in front of our eyes. It's happening now.
Yeah. And it goes back to this point, you know, that we talked about with famine, like this historical understanding of famine as something natural or something inevitable. Of course, we don't think of climate crisis like that, but I would encourage people to also think the link between climate and conflict is also not inevitable. There is an opportunity to see a different future there, but where that intersects with the kinds of politics where people are excluded, where they're marginalized, where there's high levels of inequality, where there's high levels of human rights abuses, it's more likely to see that we'll see climate as potentially a force that exacerbates rather than is kind of a direct driver. And I think that again is a factor to think about. How do we think about the politics of this? How do we think about the economics and the social policies along with that climate crisis piece? Because it's not even enough to say we need to tackle the climate crisis. We have to look at the political institutions that mean that climate crisis is experienced so differently by people in different parts of the world, but even within countries that we might think of in general as vulnerable to the climate, that people who are marginalized or vulnerable within those countries are going to experience that very differently as well. And that's a political question, not necessarily even one about kind of resources and emissions. That's also about the politics and the governance of those places.
When you stand back and look at this, it's a massive, massive issue with many aspects that need to be solved. But what are the right steps we could be taking right now? What do we need to be doing right now? If I start with you first, Rachel, and then come to you, Katrina, on that one.
In relation to the climate specifically?
Yeah, well, no, in relation to.
If we gave you a magic wand, what two or three things would you think we should be doing immediately if we'd won the battle for hearts and minds? Because that's a lot of it's going to come down to that as well.
It's all down to governance, though. It really is. If you look at the Pandora Papers earlier in the week, and you just pause on those for a minute, and then you look at, you know, where deals are being made, where, you know, people are pals with pals who you'd never expect them to have these kind of relationships with. And one of the points I saw, which was really interesting, was you see how a lot of the offshore arrangements being made and the tax avoidance that you keep coming back to, and then this pressure on overseas development aid and the idea that the rich countries need to help the poor countries, whereas it's never that simple. If we were to really look at how resources are being exploited, who's making money, where's the money going, who's making money from the money that was taken out of countries, whether it's resource extraction or, you know, all of those issues, it does come back to that and that issue of accountability. And I think one of the biggest challenges that we see, and again, as Katrina was saying, you know, fair play to Ireland in a sense for putting some of these really sticky issues on the table at the Security Council and meeting massive resistance. You know, Russia did not want climate on the agenda at the Security Council because they don't see it as a security issue. All the issues around state sovereignty and whether you meddle in the business of another country in order to prevent a crisis from happening. All of these issues require massive amounts of political will. And I think one of the biggest challenges we have to try and kind of grapple with is how do we get behind this idea that we don't want to be part of a system that where we know that people are being abused on one end of the world because of the choices that are being made by the other end. And it, so I think it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, if you look at like housing in Ireland, where we started this conversation, all those choices are, they're made on profit. They're made on who's going to benefit. And that's what we have to, where we have that to is, take that lens.
Katrina, you said it. You used the words inequality amongst some of this earlier, and that is where it boils down to, whether it's inequality in the housing market, and it's, you know, I'm thinking of the shrinking of the public sphere that's happened over the last 30 years, how things that used to be free became privatized, and this is where the wealth extraction comes from. This is where the dispossession happens, and this is why, you know, I was talking to my sister, and she'll kill me, but I said, because she's a little bit, good bit younger, and I said, you're the first generation that's worse off than your parents were at the same age. I slipped the net. but you know, this, when we look at that, that inequality is baked into how we do business, Katrina. Yeah. What do we do?
Well, I think it certainly that question of inequality and that idea that we're all interconnected, I think we have to think about those two things together. And I think if we look at our foreign policy, if we look at how Ireland has presented itself and has acted and has, as Rachel said, has put issues on the table and has presented itself as a principled actor in terms of this opportunity on the Security Council, those are really admirable things. And I think we should really applaud and commend them. But I think we should also be asking, where is the gap between our international or foreign policy and then our domestic policy? And I think it's fantastic to say we want to be an actor in the multilateral system that draws attention to the climate crisis. But we need to be thinking then, how do we actually close the gap between that international or that global commitment and that global stance, and then what we're saying and what we're doing at home? And similarly on issues, Ireland was a really key player in the UN Declaration on Refugees and Migrants. And that's a fantastic contribution to make globally. But are we living up to those same kinds of commitments domestically? And I think when we think about, you know, Rachel mentioned the Sustainable Development Goals earlier, when we think about the vision of the Sustainable Development Goals, what makes them different to the earlier Millennium Development Goals is that those are not about the global south or saying this is an agenda for action for poorer countries and you guys need to catch up. That's about saying we all have a responsibility universally. And I think that the next frontier in terms of living up to that global ambition of Ireland wanting to be a force for peace, a force and a voice for equality and sustainability, is to say, how do we close these gaps where we're seeing that inequality domestically, so that we come back to that point about credibility, so that you're a credible actor on the international stage and you're not saying this is how other countries should deal with the climate crisis. You're saying this is what it takes from all of us to show this leadership and make those difficult choices.
Lead by example, I think, is what you've just said, Katrina. Katrina and Rachel, thank you so much for having this conversation with us. And we could probably do another couple of hours on this. There's a lot in it.
Well, there's more to come back to.
But thank you so much for having this conversation. It was very nice for you to take the time out and have it. And hopefully this podcast will go quite wide. A lot of people interested in this subject.
Thanks so much.
Rachel, where can people support you guys?
Oh, for the campaign, thanks for asking, Tony. The campaign on Nothing Kills Like Hunger is at act.concern.net. And that's where you'll find more information on our work and everything. But really what we're hoping is that if people could sign the letter to global leaders, which is around addressing conflict and conflict-induced hunger. And so it's a start. And what we really want to do is engage people in the issue and start to really kind of get it up the agenda a little bit.
Great. Well, I'll add a link to that in the blurb, folks. So it'll make it nice. I'll make it so easy for you. All you have to do is look at your phone screen now and tap that button and you can go from there. Katrina Dowd, it was a pleasure to talk to you. And Rachel, it was a pleasure to talk to you again. And I'm sorry it took us so long to come back to you guys. And we'll be back, I think, on Sunday, Martin, with another bloody show. So
Sunday show, which we really enjoy. I really, really enjoy getting up early and doing a Sunday show.
he gets up at 5 to 12. we have although Sinead Mercier is going to join us, so It's always great. It's always great when Sinead shows up. So listen, folks, thanks for your support. Please tell people if you're listening to this, okay? If you're listening to this, because we've no ads, we've no sponsors, we rely on patrons. We are clinging on, and I mean that, clinging on. So if you can help us out, please do. But other than that, just tell people. Maybe other people will find us and listen. Talk to you all very, very soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.